We don't have a quorum quite yet, so when we do, we'll do the minutes, but right now we'd like to proceed. Today we have the projects included in the 2015 special session bonding bill, and we're going to be reviewing a number of those projects. First off is the Steele County Public Works Building. Do we have anyone in the audience that wants to testify for that project? All right, if you'd like to come to the DS there and identify yourself for the record and give us your testimony.
Okay, it is on. My name is Anita Benson. I'm the Director of Public Works and County Engineer for Steele County. I'm here to give you an update on a project you funded in 2015 in the special session, which is a public works facility to be constructed in the city of Owatonna. This project has a great deal of history. I'll try to be brief. It stemmed from September 22, 2010, when Steele County in southeastern Minnesota experienced a significant flood event. The project, that flood event flooded our highway facilities and from 5 to 7 feet of water in those facilities. Interesting note, in 1965, those facilities belonged to the Minnesota Department of Transportation, and after the 1965 flood, which wasn't as severe, the DOT, the state, moved them to a different port location in Owatonna. So the project we've been working on from 2010 to about 2015, the community, the county board, did a lot of planning on how to replace that facility. We maybe didn't need all that time for the planning, but we were waiting for a resolution from FEMA on what funding they might have due to the damages from the flood event to assist with replacing that facility. And in May of 2015, we did receive from FEMA notification that we were eligible for $1.6 million to assist in constructing a facility. And obviously, in May 2015, this committee and the legislature appropriated the $4 million to also assist with that facility. And so we moved forward with the project on two tracks. We had two timelines. FEMA had a timeline that we had a deadline of December 31 of 2016 to expend the funding that they would provide. And so the track for building the actual main building needed more time. So we split it into two phases. There was a phase one, which would use FEMA funding and county funding, which began construction in July of this year. That was the site work, all the site utilities, salt sand shed, a fuel facility. However, from July through September this year, we had more than 40 inches of rain, which everyone here probably realizes when you're doing earthwork, working with soils, that can present a challenge. Our normal rainfall for Owatonna for those months is a total of 13 inches. And in September, we had another presidential declared flood event where the facilities that we had moved out of flooded again. They had 2 to 3 feet of water in the building, so we were grateful that we weren't back in there and having to evacuate again. So that project, FEMA, for the phase one part of the project, they did grant us a time extension through September of this year to just in recognition of how wet it was, to allow us more time, and hopefully it'll be a dry spring, and we'll be able to complete that portion of the project. So the portion you're probably most interested in is our phase two portion, which is completing the main facility, which is a shop, highway garage, repair bays, and office building. We've worked through a lot of different options over the years leading up to this project, and What we had proceeded forward with was called the Option 2 facility, which was about, for the main building, roughly 70,000 square foot facility. And now as we're moving forward, the county board obviously needs to come up with how they are going to pay for the portion of the building that would remain the county's obligation. And if any of you are familiar with local government finance, our option is really general obligation bonding, and there's a very specific process that we would go through with the board. And we've had changes on the board, obviously, since 2010 when this happened. That's that has brought some different viewpoints potentially to the project. And so the county board right now, while we have the Option 2 building constructed, is looking at what options they would have to maybe scale back that main facility, the main building portion in Phase 2, to basically control costs more as we go through our capital improvement planning process. There are many other priorities in the county for capital improvements. Not the least would be our historic courthouse, which experienced a pipe burst in January this year and has been evacuated, and we have the courts relocated now. So the county board is considering all the different priorities for capital investment funding and is looking at what options they have to scale back and reduce costs for the Option 2 building. And that is my report. I would stand open for any questions.
Thank you, Ms. Benson. Are there any questions from the committee members about this project? Ms. Benson, I have one. So is it your testimony that really this project right now is in a bit of a state of flux, and in terms of the financing for this project and the bonding request, is that possibly going to change?
I don't know if the bonding request would change. The county board and the community are very grateful for the $4 million that was allocated for this project. I think we're more at looking at before we would move forward and let bids sell the bonds locally to fund the county's portion of the project is basically the county board taking a hard look at the building itself they're moving forward with. And you know, we have three new commissioners this year, and if you've worked with county boards, you know, anyone coming in new, there's going to be a lot of questions and getting up to speed time. But, you know, anything is possible, but I think the county is committed to replacing the facility, and the board understands the timeline for obligating that funding by the 2019 at the latest to not come back.
Ms. Benson, is there at this point in time then there's no financing in place, there's no local match?
The way the financing works at the local level, the county board goes through a process where they assess all their capital needs, and then they develop and lay out over the next 5 to 10 years what those capital needs are and which ones are committed to funding and how. For example, with our roads systems, we have a 10-year plan laid out that's funded through gas tax, wheelage tax, local option sales tax. That goes into the overall package that is submitted to our financing into when we sell bonds. And so putting that together, we're in that process with the board. They need to present a complete capital investment picture to be able to sell those bonds. The county is, you know, financially from a debt service standpoint, fully capable of coming up with their share of the funding, and I believe committed to doing so.
Thank you, Ms. Benson. We have a question. Representative Becker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Benson, this building was a total loss.
Yes, it was. It's in the 100-year floodplain, and we went through numerous exercises with FEMA in looking at could the site be reused? Could we flood-proof the site, i.e., put in flood walls or raise the buildings on the site above the 100-year floodplain meeting the city ordinance? And neither of those options was determined to be financially feasible, not to say anything about the actual technical feasibility. So, yes, those buildings are a complete loss. They have been secured. The county is working with the City Economic Development Group and looking at what we do as far as redevelopment of that site. So there's a lot of work left to be done there, and obviously there's demolition of those buildings that would need to occur, and that's not a bond-eligible expenditure either for the state nor for the county. So that's another financial obligation outside of bonding. The county it has.
Follow-up, Representative Eklund.
One follow-up, Mr. Chair. Thank you. So was there any MCIT claims that came out of that and or FEMA claims? Because being a former county commissioner, I went through a flood, so I know there's a lot of that kind of stuff that...
Absolutely. Worked with both. I'll take the easy one, although it took a long time. With FEMA, that's where their $1.6 million came from for that they would allow us to do a project. There was also, there were items within those buildings that that FEMA has covered, and we're still, believe it or not, working with them. As far as MCIT goes, they were great to work with. They had on our rolling stock or trucks and different damages to equipment like that. We had coverage for that, but MCIT doesn't do flood coverage, and the county did not have separate flood insurance for the facilities. I don't know why. I think, back in history, that wasn't something that was focused on.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Halsman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Maybe the question to you. I was sort of trying to listen, read between the lines. It's fairly unusual to go back and look at a bill that we passed a couple of years ago. We're doing it this meeting, and I think again in the next meeting where we're revisiting projects. Is there are we looking for something as we do this, or what's the?
Well, Representative Hausman, I'm only the vice chair. I have no idea. But let's hope, huh? So, yes. Any further questions?
So we don't know why we're revisiting the old projects?
Representative Hausman, I think Chair Erdahl might mention and talk a little bit about that when he gets done presenting his bill.
Okay.
Right. Any further questions? Is there anyone in the audience that would like to speak to the Steele County Public Works building? Anyone out there? Okay. Thank you, Ms. Benson, for your testimony.
Thank you very much for your time.
We'll interrupt testimony at this point in time. We do have some minutes to approve. Let's see. They're the February 8th minutes. Representative Frankie, could you approve the minutes for us?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have gone over the minutes, and I will move them.
All right. Have a motion. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. All right. Next, we have the Polk County Solid Waste Facility. John Steiner. Is John here? Good afternoon, gentlemen. Please identify yourself for the record and begin your testimony.
Mr. Chair and committee members, my name is Kirk Adelka. I'm Assistant Commissioner for the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency, which also supports and has recommended this to the governor in the past, but I will not be doing the bulk of the speaking, so I'll pass it on to my colleague.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Committee members, my name is John Steiner. I'm the Environmental Services Director for Polk County, Northwest Minnesota. Part of my duties up there are to oversee Polk County's solid waste recycling zoning programs. And also we have several solid waste facilities that we operate on behalf of a regional partnership up there. And that partnership would be between Beltrami, Clearwater, Hubbard, Manoman, Norman, and, of course, Polk County. So it's with that part of it that I'm here. I was invited to testify in front of you today. I guess going back a little bit on our project, we had applied for a solid waste expansion project on behalf of the regional group through the MPCA's Capital Assistance Program grant. That requires bond funding, so we had applied in 2013, again in 14, and then in 2015 we were awarded a grant through the legislature. Of course, it came in the special session, and that delayed things a little bit, and it was for about roughly half of our requested allocation. And because of that, we've encountered a number of things that have slowed the project, slowed the progress on the project. And as I understood to believe, really, there were a few questions to answer here, and one was, you know, the progress that we've made since 2015's appropriation, and what money's been spent and what's remaining. So can I take that backwards in order? Of the roughly $8 million we received in capital assistance program, which, like I said, was about half of the request, about $250,000 was for design, engineering, and permitting. The balance of it was capital, and so just looking at the timelines on things, you can't spend any money under the program until you have an executed grant agreement. So when the appropriation was made in early May 2015, we then had to execute grant agreements with the state between the partner counties. We were looking at originally some execution date to that grant agreement somewhere to fall between the fall and end of 2015, so we could do our design, engineering, permitting work early in the late winter and early spring and hit the 2016 construction window. Unfortunately, because of a number of things, and one of them was the partial funding of the project, and there were some complications related to one portion of the project we had, the grant agreement wasn't actually executed until March of 2016. So by the time we were able to start spending money under that, start the design engineering, it became pretty obvious relatively quickly we were not going to hit the 2016 construction window. One of the complications in partial funding, what's referred to, I believe, in the enabling legislation as phase one of the project, is that the intent legislatively was to get us money to get us going. There was a window of opportunity when a bunch of the contracts in the region came open. We have a long history of working with the other counties and cities and private entities in our region as a service provider. And to try and hit that and get going, we had a very short window of about 2 years to do that. Otherwise, everyone was going to enter into agreements where they had been, and we'd be waiting another 10, 15 years for that sort of opportunity. So the intent was basically to get us money to get us started. Basically, if there are five buildings, try and get five foundations in the ground, the second phase of the money hopefully coming in the 2016 normal bonding year. Once we had the legislation and went through it, that the intent doesn't comply with the grant requirements, which require us to have basically complete projects. So we, once the award was made, then we had to go back, work with the MPCA staff to identify full portions of projects. Essentially, no one wants to have a foundation sitting there without a shell on top of it. So we had to basically reconfigure our project, prioritize with the money we had, and come up with complete projects. And so that's what we did. We broke that down into two projects. One was the Beltrami Transfer Station. There were a number of issues happening in Beltrami County affecting their ability to deliver waste related to equipment, the condition of the building, ownership of the building, and contract issues. So Beltrami County having the money to do that and clarify those issues and assure that they'd be able to honor their contracts with us and eliminate the issues out there for the rest of the counties in the partnership. That was identified as a priority. The other one was to get started on the what was called the resource recovery expansion. We identified as a phase one of that, and that wasn't enough money to do the entire project, so what we were going to do is put up the building, put in the equipment to the point where the budget ran out, make sure we had an operating project, and hopefully have the money come back in 2016 to finish that project. So we had to go back and redesign, re-engineer that component of it. Of course, 2016, there wasn't a bonding bill that was approved. And so we've kind of sat idle trying to reconfigure how we're going to go forward without this. So that's in kind of a nutshell where we've been on the project. There has been a lot of work done. Between then and now, we've got all of our permit applications in. Things are pending. We just received our landfill permit, I believe it was February 16th of this year, which would impact a phase two portion of the project. We've moved all the utilities and everything with the city to accomplish the construction of the project. Engineering on the building, I would say, is about 80-90% complete. The intent is to have bid specs out early April and construction into summer, fall of this year on that portion of the project. So, you know, not quite sure exactly what the goal is here, but I guess the takeaway on this from our end of it is that while we're trying to make the project work, and we'll certainly end up with a workable project at the end, you know, to get everything going the way it is and to cut to what we're right now experiencing as far as some difficulties in contracts and overtime and maybe not the most efficient use of money trying to make things work until we can do the other half of the project is hopefully getting that second phase of that funding in, I would hope, 2017, if I could put that plug in there, but certainly keep us in mind whenever there's a bonding bill coming forth from this body.
Thank you, Mr. Steiner, for your testimony. Commissioner Kudelka, do you have anything to add?
Mr. Chair and committee members, other than we support the project, Polk County and Mr. Steiner have done a great job putting together a number of counties, and that's what we ask them to do, is work together to create an integrated solid waste system. And that's what this proposal is, taking a lot of different aspects of how we want solid waste handled, all the way from compost and recycling to waste energy to landfilling. And we support the project. We're, Governor has it in his bonding bill recommendation last year and now this year to finalize the project, to complete it, so that it can continue to get up and running and serve the region as a whole.
Thank you, Commissioner. Anybody on the commission or the, here in the committee that would like to have a question for our testifiers? Seeing none, is there anyone in the audience that would like to give testimony about the Polk County Solid Waste Facility? Seeing none, thank you, gentlemen. It's informational, so very good. Thank you. Next, we have the Public Facilities Authority, Scott Payne, I hope I have that correct, General Manager of the Worthington Public Works Public Utilities. Thanks for coming over this afternoon, gentlemen. Please identify yourself for the record and start your testimony.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Scott Hain. I'm General Manager of Worthington Public Utilities and also a member of the Lewis and Clark Regional Water System Board of Directors.
I'm Troy Larson, Executive Director of the Lewis and Clark Regional Water System, and behind me is Red Arndt, who's the Chairman of the Lewis and Clark Board from Laverne.
Go ahead with your testimony.
Okay, in 2015, Lewis and Clark received $19 million in appropriation bond funding for phase two of the Minnesota portion of the Lewis and Clark Regional Water System project. That came after a $22 million appropriation in 2014, which constructed the system from the Iowa border to Laverne and then partially to Magnolia. The 2015 appropriation was to complete the construction to Magnolia and then also construct from Magnolia to near Adrian, Minnesota, where Lincoln Pipestone Rural Water System's connection to Lewis and Clark would be, and also allowed for engineering and land acquisition for phase three, which would be the portion between Lincoln Pipestone's connection near Adrian and Worthington, which would be the last Minnesota connection of Lewis and Clark. out of that appropriation of $19 million, those were an appropriation bond, so the bonds were sold based on cash flow projections to date. Approximately $11.6 million of appropriation bonds have been sold to fund that or finance that portion of the project. The connection has been completed to Magnolia. Construction is underway between Magnolia and Adrian, and the majority of the engineering has been completed, and all of the easement acquisition has been done between Adrian and Worthington. So at this point in time, what would remain that needed to be funded would be construction between Adrian and Worthington. It is becoming pretty apparent. We expect that we will not be able to utilize the entire $19 million. We did run into a very competitive bidding environment. We estimate out of the $19 million appropriation that we received that there could be an estimated $8 million that would go unspent. Consequently, we have two standalone bills introduced, one in the House and one in the Senate, that would remove the geographic limitation of that $19 million and allow us to spend that remaining roughly $8 million on construction between Adrian and Worthington. And both of those bills have been introduced in their respective chambers and have been referred to committees. And as of yet, we have not had a hearing in committee.
That language is also in the final bill.
Pardon? Oh, yes. And we are also in the Senate version of the bonding bill and the governor's recommendations for final phase three funding.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Hine. I have a question for you. Who are the authors of those bills?
It would be Representative Hamilton in the House and Senator Weber in the Senate. And those would be House File 635 and Senate File 543.
Mr. Hank, the $8 million you're testifying that that will be unspent will be used for additional construction. You mentioned between what, Adrian and Worthington?
That, yes, sir, Mr. Chair, that is correct. What essentially it would do is the dollars that we received in 2015, those are phase two portion of the construction, which limited construction to Lake and Pipestone's connection near Adrian, with full intention that phase three would be construction between Adrian and Worthington. If we were able to utilize that $8 million surplus, that would be utilized on phase three construction and then would consequently just reduce our ask for phase three appropriations, essentially dollar for dollar.
Very good. Thank you, Mr. Hain. Further question. Phase three, will that be the completion of the project?
That will be the completion of the Minnesota portion of Lewis and Clark, correct.
Thank you. Representative Carlson.
Just a quick question. Looking at the map that was handed out, it looks like there's a future route from between Worthington and where that yellow bit is down into Sibley in Iowa. And how do we handle the cost of the pipeline going through Minnesota when it's going to service what appears here in the Iowa community?
Mr. Chair, Representative, the cost of the pipeline of that turnout to serve Sibley, Iowa has specifically been removed from any cost calculations. The only dollars that we have asked for from Minnesota are just to put the portion of the pipeline that will serve the Minnesota members in the ground. The future pipeline going down to serve Sibley would either have to be picked up with or paid for with future federal funds for the project or funding from the state of Iowa.
So,
Representative Carlson.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, then the way you answered that is there going to be that future pipeline? Are there some communities in Minnesota that will be served by that pipeline that's, I'll call it a spinoff, down to Sibley? Or is that strictly an Iowa on need?
That
Mr. Hay.
Yes, sir, Mr. Chair. That will strictly go to Sibley, Iowa, and Sibley will be the only community in, or system served off of that pipeline.
Thank you.
Representative Salk.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm the new guy here. So is this a rural water system as well as a linked municipal, or is it just linked municipal?
Mr. Hayne? Mr. Chair, the system consists of 20 either municipal water systems or rural water systems in the three states of Iowa, South Dakota, and Minnesota. In Minnesota, there are two municipal system members. That would be the city of Laverne and the city of Worthington. And there are also two rural water systems, one being Rock County Rural Water and the other being Lincoln Pipestone Rural Water System.
Thank you. Representative Sock?
That's it.
Okay. Any further questions from the committee? Is there anyone in the audience that would like to testify on the Lewis and Clark Pipeline Project? Gentlemen, do you have anything further to add for the committee?
No, just appreciate the opportunity. Thank you for your time.
Thank you for coming down. Appreciate it.
I think I ended up with two of these somehow.
Next on the agenda, we have a Department of Transportation project, Vicksburg Lane Railroad Crossing and Richfield Street Underpass. I believe we have Jeff Peterson, the city engineer. Gentlemen, thank you for coming before the committee today. Please identify yourself for the record and start out with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Steve Devich. I'm the city manager of the city of Richfield. And I'll let
Jeff Pearson, city engineer for Richfield. So I'll just give you a little bit of a background. We're talking about the 77th Street underpass today. I'll give you a little bit of background for those maybe not familiar with the project, and then Steve will kind of relay some of the issues we've been having to date on that funding. So 77th Street is a four-lane arterial, runs parallel to 494, and is a reliever to 494 through the city of Richfield. Very similar in nature to American Boulevard on the Bloomington side of 494. There's been a series of projects in that area to improve flow and congestion on 494 and set it up for future expansion. Lindale Avenue Bridge over 494, the Penn Avenue Bridge, Xerxes Avenue Bridge, and then the construction of American Boulevard and the construction of 77th Street. The last element of 77th Street construction that needs to take place would be this underpass of Trunk Highway 77. It's basically a gap in the system between the airport side of Trunk Highway 77 and the Richfield side of the highway. So the project was awarded or funded $2.5 million for design in 2014, and that's well underway. We've gotten a MnDOT staff-approved layout of the project, and we're moving into final design. It's also received the $10 million bonding in the 2015 cycle, and then we were just awarded named as a recipient for the $7 million in federal funding under the most recent regional solicitation process. Additionally, we've gotten $1.5 million for right-of-way from Hennepin County. So that money was available immediately, so we began the right-of-way acquisition process for the project. But it's we need a portion of that $10 million in state bonding to complete the right-of-way acquisition, and that's a little bit what Steve will talk to.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Peterson. Devish. Sorry.
It's fine. Thank you. To this point, the things were moving along. We got the $10 million in the 2015 bonding cycle, and the understanding was when that was written that we'd be able to use that a portion of that for acquisition and then a larger portion of that for construction. So we got to the point where we are working on and have gotten the appraisals for the one piece of property that needs to be acquired. We went to secure a portion of that funding to be able to make an offer on that property, and came to find out that it wasn't interpreted that we would be able to use that money until all of the funding for the project was complete. And again, with our understanding, that was never the intent of the original legislation, and so right now we're kind of stopped in our tracks. To fix that, there is a bill in House File 1125 that's authored by Representative Slocum, and in the Senate File 1021, authored by Senator Wicklund, that would change the language or modify the language to allow us to proceed to use part of that $10 million for that piece of the acquisition. That change doesn't cost the state any more money. It just follows through with what we had thought all along would be, you know, our opportunity. But right now we're kind of stopped in our tracks. And you know, we spent the money and working on the appraisals, and my understanding is that if something doesn't happen with our ability to move forward with an offer in the next, 2 to 3 months, then that's going to become stale, and we're going to have to start that all over again. So that would be a real setback for us. You know, again, otherwise, with the engineering and all of that aspect of it, it's moving along just fine, but we're at the point where we're basically knocking on the door, and we need to get that property acquisition, and that's where we're kind of stalled out right now. So those two bills would be very, very critical in our ability to fix this matter and move forward.
Thank you. Understandable. Are there any questions from committee members on this project? Anything further to add, gentlemen?
No, thank you for listening to us, and again, this is a great project, and we hope to be able to get it moving along really quickly.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Next, we have the Plymouth-Vicksburg Lane Rail Crossing. Please identify yourself for the record.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, my name is Jim Lundberg, and I'm the city engineer for the city of Plymouth. Thank you for having me today. A little background on our project. The Vicksburg Lane project is located in the northwest part of the city. Before construction, it was a rural two-lane roadway, and due to the booming development surrounding the area, it has projected volume of 15,000 vehicles per day. Because of the high demand, and because of the aging infrastructure along this roadway, the need for a reconstruction and expansion project was necessary. Within the project corridor was a Canadian Pacific Railway crossing, where 20 to 30 trains would travel through this crossing each and every day. What's unique about this crossing is that Vicksburg Lane would cross the Canadian Pacific Railway on a curve. When the train speeds were 25 miles per hour, there wasn't any issues with the traveling public getting across this road because the crossing was relatively flat. However, in 2013, Canadian Pacific Railway increased the speeds of their trains to 40 miles an hour. This resulted in the railway relaying a portion of their tracks on this curve to create a super elevation so that way the trains could stay on their tracks going 40 miles an hour. This resulted in a bump along Vicksburg Road, Vicksburg Lane, that caused some issues to the traveling public. The speeds on Vicksburg Lane were 50 miles an hour. We posted advisory plaques to slow them down to 30 miles an hour along with flashing beacons, but many people did not adhere to those speeds. Anyone not going over or not going under 30 miles an hour would either bottom out their vehicle or, at worst, end up in the ditch and maybe hit a power pole. Due to this safety concern, as well as this being an active rail line, our city council approved a grade-separated crossing over the CP rail tracks. In the spring of 2015, we heard the wonderful news that the Vicksburg project was included in the state bonding bill in the amount of $4.7 million to help pay for the bridge. Plymouth Mayor Kelly Slavic, our city council, and our city manager Dave Callister worked with former Senators Terry Bonoff and Senator Ann Russ, as well as Representatives Lyndon Carlson and Sarah Anderson, to secure funding for this project. The Plymouth delegation then worked with the Governor, as well as the House and Senate Transportation Committees, to include the request in the bill. As stated by our Mayor last October during the ribbon cutting for this bridge, we are grateful that we are grateful for everyone's efforts on this project. After hearing the funding news for the bill, I worked closely with the State Aid Office to ensure that everything was done properly and on time. And one of the most important questions I asked the State Aid representatives was what's needed to get it done on time, and they responded, well, what's your project schedule? With what we provided them, we then worked backwards to ensure that the project could start on time. I'm happy to say that last spring, in March of 2016, the project did begin, with there being no major delays in the process to secure the agreement. And then due to the hard work from our contractor, the Vicksburg Lane project, as well as the bridge, was substantially completed of fall of last year and then opened to the public on October 25th of 2016. Again, I thank you very much for you having me here today, and I can stand for any questions.
Very good. Thank you, Mr. Herberg. Representative Considine, hello there.
Hi.
You have a question?
Hi.
Yes.
No, I don't. Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the guys, though, that are in the Public Safety Committee, the other day we were talking about sunsetting an assessment for the railroads, for railroad safety, and this is what I was referring to in the committee. It's all over the state. We have at-grade crossings that are dangerous, and thank you for bringing it up. And thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right. Representative Carlson.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, when we presented the bill in capital investment, in fact, I probably still have the pictures in my file, and I just want to reinforce what the testifier said about it being a real safety issue with the high volume, and then what I'll describe as that bump or the grade, and had pictures of cars that had ended up in accidents in the ditch and so on. And so it did resolve a major safety issue. The other thing is that when you referenced that you got the good news, I heard from the city manager that it was the first bonding request that the city of Plymouth, city of 75,000, had ever had or accomplished here at the legislature. So that was also a bit of a footnote I wanted to point out.
Thank you, Representative Carlson. I would also just like to mention the fact that rail safety is a huge problem in my district also, represent part of Coon Rapids. And we have two very, very serious rail crossings that inhibit public safety vehicles from getting places on time. There still are considerable amount of oil trains that cross the Twin Cities area, and so these rail crossing upgrades are very important. Are there any further questions? Seeing none, thank you very much for your testimony.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. Okay, we have next the University of Minnesota, Trevor Ames, who's the Dean of the College of Veterinary Medicine. Dean Ames, please identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Trevor Ames, Dean of the College of Veterinary Medicine, and it's my privilege to be here today and report on two very important capital projects involving the College of Veterinary Medicine at the University of Minnesota. Hopefully, by now, you have two handouts involving the first project I'll talk about, the Minnesota Poultry Testing Lab. This handout is a summary of the function of the Minnesota Poultry Testing Lab and its operation. And this handout is just some pictures of the project for your reference. Briefly, the project is a Minnesota Poultry Testing Lab is part of our veterinary diagnostic lab system, and it is a shared operation with the Minnesota Board of Animal Health. It does surveillance testing for our diagnostic lab for testing involving the poultry industry, and the Board of Animal Health operates its National Poultry Improvement Plan out of the Minnesota Poultry Testing Lab as well. This was an $8.5 million project that was completely funded by the legislature. The project was fast-tracked in design and construction to improve the state's ability to respond to highly pathogenic avian influenza as well as other poultry diseases. So after we received the wonderful news that the project was funded in June of 2015, we began planning. We broke ground in December of 2015 and moved into the facility in September of 2016. And many legislators were present for the groundbreaking as well as the ribbon cutting events. The new facility is a remodeled expansion of the existing building. It has added state-of-the-art equipment. The new building is considerably larger. It's a 12,000 square foot facility, which will provide capacity and flexibility for providing service to the poultry industry for years to come. The new facility also features site improvement, including parking. And I should note that the City of Wilmer partnered with us to make additional parking and access available for an additional 23 spots from the adjacent community center. Expansion to the facility in Wilmer was done so that we could move testing closer to the poultry community, which is certainly critical in a disease outbreak like that involving highly pathogenic avian influenza. The facility also includes conference space and technology for improved communications and can act as a command center when needed. This facility was built as a result of a strong partnership between the University of Minnesota, the Board of Animal Health, the legislature, the governor, and the poultry community. All was this partnership was required in order to make this a success. So I'm pleased to say that the project was completed on time, on budget. No one got hurt during the construction of the project, and we only lost 4 days of testing due to relocation and downtime that involved two moves in and out of temporary laboratory space. Thank you for making this facility possible. The new facility is one step among many that have occurred and have helped us be better prepared for the next infectious disease outbreak involving poultry. I do want to recognize the University of Minnesota Capital Planning and Project Management Group for their rapid work on this project, and also recognize Alliance Architects and the Goff Construction for their work on the project. Are there any questions on the Minnesota Poultry Testing Lab?
Thank you, Dean Ames. Do we have any questions from the committee? I do have one, Dean Ames. So we soon will be getting into the season where we did have that tremendous horrible outbreak. Do we have any indications around the country or within the state of Minnesota on any possible problems?
Around the country, there have been reports of, I think in one of the western states, Wyoming or Montana, of an isolate from wild waterfowl. And I do not believe to date we have any reports of isolates involving the Minnesota poultry industry.
I do have one other follow-up, Dean Ames. The University of Minnesota did a wonderful job with a very small facility and very few people working during the last outbreak. I know that you were shuttling samples around all over. With the new facility, from a logistics standpoint and things, could you explain a little bit about how it's going to work better?
Sure. So the previous Minnesota Poultry Testing Lab was able to do testing for antibodies called serology and also testing for bacterial agents called microbiology, but they couldn't do any rapid testing to detect a virus. In addition, they were not approved by the USDA to do that testing. The new facility has the equipment and the trained personnel to allow them to do the rapid viral detection test, and they have been approved by USDA to do that testing, and they are running some of the tests right now. So we are continuing to run tests both in St. Paul and now also at the Minnesota Poultry Testing Lab in Wilmer. In addition, we are getting other technicians trained up. This testing requires specific training that has to be approved by the USDA, and so we're getting additional techs trained up from the poultry testing lab so that we have what's called surge capacity. We will have all of the techs that do that testing here in the St. Paul lab already for surge capacity, and we're even working with the National Guard. They have technicians that can also help out in these situations as well. So for that particular test, I think that we will be in a much better position, and probably most importantly, the samples won't have to be transported from Wilmer or west of Wilmer into St. Paul. They can be transported to Wilmer.
Thank you. Next, we'd like to discuss the veterinary isolation facility. Oh, excuse me, Representative Detmer.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. And Dean, some of the testing you do, is there any research done in terms of prevention?
Dean Ames?
So there's been a lot happen, and that 2015 legislative session not only funded the facility that I just got done describing, but it also funded response money and research money for high path avian influenza. So I could give you the 20-minute answer or the 2-minute answer. Briefly, there's been a lot done around prevention, including improved biosecurity on virtually every farm in Minnesota. And this has included not only the veterinary school, but also the College of Agriculture and the Minnesota Extension. In fact, one of our agricultural engineers has created a biosecure entry and exit trailer where individuals can be trained about how to enter and exit through proper biosecure portals, often called the Danish entry system. And we have an extension educator, Abby New, who is taking this trailer all over the state to train a variety of groups in how to enter poultry facilities without introducing disease. We've also done a lot of things to improve our early detection system. There's been a lot of improvements to how the state would respond in terms of depopulation of farms, and also there's been improvements to what's called the business continuity plan, where we can do permitting and testing to allow product movement in and out of control zones. So I think that we're in much better shape, and I'd be happy to talk to you more if you have other questions.
Thank you. Let's move to the isolation lab.
So again, thank you for this opportunity, Mr. Chair and committee members, to give this report. Again, you should have two handouts for this. This is a one-pager that just provides kind of an overview of the need and the project scope. And then this is just some pictures that provide you kind of an update on where we're at in the construction process. So this was also funded in the 2015 legislative session, and this will provide state-of-the-art housing for studying infectious diseases in animals. It will help us develop new diagnostic tests and surveillance systems. It will help us create new treatments and vaccines to achieve better control and prevention measures for infectious diseases involving animals in the state. And it will help us protect the health of Minnesota's animals, certainly its economy involving livestock and poultry, and also its citizens by helping prevent those diseases that can spread from animals to people. This facility replaces three buildings that were built in 1950. In 1950s, I think 58, they did not meet the current regulatory guidelines or building codes. They lacked cooling, so we couldn't use the buildings in the summer. They lacked adequate biosecurity, so we couldn't use the buildings for certain infectious agents like the high path avian influenza that we just got done talking about. So the new facility will be 31,000 square feet of animal holding, procedure rooms, and support spaces. The building has been designed for flexibility of use, high utilization, and efficiency of operation. It will allow researchers to do studies that were not possible before, making us more competitive for attracting faculty members, make us more competitive for attracting research funding, and making us better able to serve the animal agriculture of the state. The project is currently under construction. As you can see from the photos, it's slated to open the end of 2017. Important point to bring up is that this building will need to be commissioned to exact biosecurity and animal care standards once construction is complete in the fall. So there are two levels of biosecurity within this building. One is called biosecurity level 2, and one is called biosecurity level 3. For biosecurity level 2, we need 4 months of commissioning, and for biosecurity level 3, we need 9 months of commissioning. So basically, we should be open for business for the BSL-2 portion in 2018 and the BSL-3 in January of 2018, and for the BSL-3 portion in June of 2018. So roughly, BSL-2 are infectious agents that can go back and forth between animals but not people. BSL-3 are agents like high path avian influenza that could infect people, and so we need proper protocols in place to protect those individuals working with these animals. We will not be working with what are called BSL-4 agents like Ebola. So this is a very important and complex facility that will need to meet very exact standards. The building, to give you an idea of its scope, will require 142 tons of steel, 5 miles of piping, and 3 miles of ductwork so that we have proper sanitation and airflow control within the building. You can see the progress we're making, and we look forward to hosting you at a tour later this year. And I want to recognize the University Capital Planning and Project Management for their support on this project. Once again, they've been wonderful partners. The design was done again by Alliance Architects, and the construction this time was done by Knudsen Construction. And again, for both these projects, I want to thank the Minnesota State for its support. This is much needed facilities, and we are very grateful for your help. Thank you.
Thank you. Any other questions? Representative Tharp?
I'm just curious where we stand amongst the states or amongst the research facilities around the United States relative to development and state-of-the-art kind of thing.
So this will make us competitive. Certainly there were a number of other states that have built these type of facilities. States like California and Texas, and Georgia that had these types of facilities. So we will now be on par with those facilities. We have been talking about this facility for quite a while. We spent a lot of time developing the design of this project, and we feel confident that this will be a very flexible, usable, efficient facility to meet our needs going forward. And just for, you know, more completeness, the federal government has a facility like this in Ames, Iowa, and they are building a facility in Manhattan, Kansas, that will be an even higher security facility than the one in Ames, Iowa, and will replace a facility that was that is currently in use for Plum Island. So that facility in Plum Island that will be replaced with the facility in Manhattan, Kansas, will be a facility where you could work with a foreign animal disease like foot and mouth disease.
There's a sock.
Mr. Chair, I just wanted to, my question was really trying to lead toward, and you did allude to it, is that we have kind of a multi-plane that has been developed across the nation where I think security of this kind of thing is much enhanced by the fact that it's replicated in a number of places and we're not working from a pinnacle
out to other less secure places.
No, I think that's a great way of putting it. Thank you.
Representative Ugwa?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Dean, are you foreseeing with the opening of this facility and everything else, are you going to be able to help out the DNR with the chronic wasting disease problem we have here in the state with the deer herd?
This facility would allow us to work with deer, and I am not sure about whether we could work with that particular agent and whether we would get involved in transmission studies of that particular agent. I'm sorry, I would have to get back to you with more information about studies with that particular agent. It is not a virus or bacteria. It's called a prion, so it's kind of an infectious piece of protein. And so whether we could do this in a BSL-2 facility or not, or have to work with smaller deer in our BSL-3 facility, I would have to get back to you on that.
Okay. Thank you.
Any other questions? Okay, thank you, Dean Ames. What's the next one here? As the Minnesota State folks take the witness table, let me just say first, sorry for missing the first part of the meeting here. I had a bill up in higher ed that took longer than I thought, mainly because there's another one before mine. But the purpose of what we're doing today, you know, as a capital investment committee, obviously we distribute money to a lot of projects that we feel are worthy across the state. And, you know, sometimes it's good to check back and see how these projects are being carried out, how things are moving along with them. Are the pre-design and design phases of the project working as expected? And that's the purpose of what we're doing today. So with that, welcome to the testifying table. Please introduce yourself for the record.
Good afternoon, Chair Erdahl, committee. I am Brian Newitz, and I serve as the Associate Vice Chancellor for Facilities for the Minnesota State College, Minnesota State System of College Universities. Also with me is Rasul Dasmos, who is the President of St. Paul College, and he'll share his perspective on the important project going on his campus. We thank you for your time today. Bottom line, Mr. Chair and committee, is this. The projects funded as part of the 2015 legislative session are complete or well on the way to completion, already serving students or positioned to do so as the fall term begins. The bonding bill signed into law as part of the 2015 special session provided $32 million for four capital investment priorities serving five Minnesota State campuses. First, the bill provided $1.2 million for the design and renovation of existing laboratory spaces supporting manufacturing and then automotive technology programs at Anoka Technical College. The project was completed last fall, ribbon cutting in November. I think Representative Vreeland was there having some cake and checking out the manufacturing equipment. And students and faculty are taking full advantage of the bright, modernized spaces and up-to-date equipment that is reflective of that's in industry today. Our designer in that project was Stanley Consulting, and Ebert Construction was our general contractor. Next, $7.7 million was invested in the renovation and upgrade of Dakota County Technical College's heavy-duty truck and construction equipment lab spaces. This work is complete, and final portions of the project and adjacent multi-purpose and classroom areas will finish up this summer. This investment made dramatic improvements in the climate, the conditions of the lab spaces supporting the college's heavy technical programs, and created spaces reflective of the industry standards and helped our students better prepare for the high-wage, high-demand jobs that are available for them upon graduation. TKDA was our designer in this project, and Jorgensen Construction was our general contractor at Dakota County College. The next priority funding was for two projects at Minnesota West Community and Technical College. First of all, there was a project at Candy, at the Candy campus, where the HVAC system of Eglin Hall was overhauled and integrated with a geothermal field that you'll see on the, in the handout. And it's kind of a mess, but indeed there was a wells going in the ground to provide the geothermal field. Burns and McDonald was our engineer on that, or architect engineer on the project, and Bisbee Mechanical is the one integrating this mechanical system into the campus. Second, for Minnesota West, is the project at the Jackson campus, where the high voltage power training facility is well underway. This project replaces an old, obsolete, off-campus facility with a modern indoor training area to prepare students for all aspects of their trade. Slocum Crutch and Hay Dobbs is our designer on that project, and Slocum Concrete and Construction was our general contractor. Both of these projects started with funding from design through construction and are tracking for completion this summer, ready for students in the fall term. Finally, 2015 provided $18.8 million in construction funding for the Health Science Alliance Center just up the street at St. Paul College. I know many of you have seen the exciting project grow out of the ground in your travels around the city and our visits to our most recent visits to our campus. You had to navigate from the parking through the project into the campus building itself. And that's a challenge I know President Dosmos has had to do in navigating his students and staff. Mr. Chair, I'd like President Dosmos to briefly share what this project means for St. Paul College and the region.
So, Mr. Chair, Lord all and the committee, my name is Rasul Dosmos. I'm President and CEO of St. Paul College. On behalf of our 450 faculty, staff, and administrators at St. Paul College, I want to thank you and the committee and the state of Minnesota for funding this project. Funding of the Health and Science Alliance Center came at a very critical moment. The college has grown over 90% since 2002. It's designed to meet the workforce and student demand of the STEM and health sciences and allied health program. The college is the most diverse college in the state of Minnesota. It's a solution to Minnesota's workforce talent shortage. We saw double-digit increases in STEM enrollment and equally strong demand in health programs. With support of this committee, the funding for the design for the Health and Science Alliance Center began in 2012. We set out with our architect, engineer Oliver and Associates to eliminate bottlenecks associated with the design, but also the limited capacity we had in biology and chemistry lab to efficiently meet the workforce demand needs. Funding in 2015 from the bonding bill enabled us to move forward the idea into the actual design and then the construction phase. The building will be operational in June of 2017. It will house four additional science labs for biology and chemistry, two health sciences sim lab, simulation labs, practical nursing, nursing assistant, health unit coordinator, respiratory care, surgical technology, patient care, and other technical programs. Two flexible classrooms and labs to meet the demand of STEM. Those are the courses you need before you start your studies in pharmacy technician, phlebotomy, physical therapy assistant, audiology assistant, medical assistant, and occupational therapy assistant. All of these occupations have negative unemployment numbers, meaning that they're short in terms of supplies are very short. In addition, the project also constructs the University Center for a 2+2 articulation agreement with our sister universities and two flexible business industry classrooms in order to expand the workforce training needs opportunities. The contractor is Knutson, it's a local construction firm, and the project is under budget. Except to open, the building will be expected to open in 2017, June. With the Health and Sciences Alliance Center completed and ready to go this fall, we'll be able to award degrees in STEM, Associate of Science, Associate of Art, Associate of Applied Science and Biomedical Engineering Technology and Pre-Engineering programs. New health programs and degree programs will be implemented, including pharmacy technician, phlebotomy, sterile technician, certificate, surgical technology, public health, patient care technician, and gerontology. We will also be able to expand science and math sections offered to a diverse student population, expand our partnership with Metropolitan State University, prepare a growing number of students for transfer to baccalaureate STEM fields. We will be sure to invite the committee with a ribbon cutting and dedication later on this year so you can see firsthand the impact of this investment for St. Paul College and our students and our community. I thank you very much.
Well, thank you, Doctor, and thank you once again for the very fine lunch that you served.
You're always welcome.
Well, we'll probably be back.
Yeah.
Mr. Chair and Committee,
Mr. Yolitz,
to wrap up, your state colleges and universities are very grateful for the time and energy you put into reviewing, understanding, and providing the capital investments needed to maintain and improve the teaching and learning facilities and spaces of Minnesota State. This work is critical to keeping campuses and their facilities warm, safe, and dry, recruiting and retaining both incredible faculty and students, and preparing those students for Minnesota's workforce. We move quickly on projects, moving funds to action. These projects have an immediate impact in terms of jobs today, but I would argue more importantly, they continue to provide a return on investment by preparing students for life and the workforce for many years to come. We thank you for your time and attention this afternoon. We stand for any questions.
Thank you, Ms. Yolitz. And Representative Considine.
I'm sorry, no, I don't have a...
And watch how you move your hands over there.
I guess, yeah.
Well, Mr. Yolitz, just wondering how your pre-design and design matched up with the project as it unfolded. Was it as expected? Were there any surprises to you?
Mr. Chair, I think overall our pre-designs aligned up. We oftentimes, sometimes these projects take a while to mature and get through the legislative process. We did have one, the geothermal project at the Kandy campus that needed a little bit of attention in terms of matching the geothermal system with the mechanical system. So we were able to use some HEPA money to help, because the HEPA work needed to be done anyway, to align that project and bring it up to snuff. But all in all, I think we're right on track and in producing some very, very good projects.
Okay, thank you. Any other questions? Well then, thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
I believe now we have the DNR.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Welcome to the committee. Introduce yourself, please, and proceed.
I'm Kent Lockesmore, Director of Capital Investment for DNR. And first, thank you for your past support for this program. And we'll give you a brief update on the flood hazard mitigation program. And members all have a handout that came around. But first, since there are a number of new members, I'd like to give a brief background on the program. This program is a cost-share grants. It provides cost-share grants to local governments. And the priorities for the grants are based on flood risk, the extent, the frequency, the severity of flooding, and also then the project readiness of a entity to proceed. We also look at leveraging other funds, either FEMA or the Corps of Engineers project funds. So the cost share under this program, and the statutory cost share under 103F-161, it's a 50-50 cost share. But since 1998, after the East Grand Forks flood, there's been rider language that provides for a cost share to assist local governments, and that's been the 2%. It limits the local cost share to 2% of the median household income times the number of households. And that was done because a small community like East Grand Forks couldn't afford about a $30 million half of the non-federal share. There are benefits to this program. The studies from FEMA show that there's $4 of benefits for every $1 we spend on mitigation. And Minnesota today is much more flood resilient than it was before this program commenced in 1987. We've removed 3,700 homes from the floodplain that have been acquired and moved out of harm's way. And there's many thousands more that have been protected by the construction of levees and other protective works. So there has been significant headways in this program, and there still is demand for the program. As you'll see on the spreadsheet, this shows what where the allocation of the 2015 flood hazard grants have gone. It's $23.549 million. And you look at that, we've now it's 99.7% of it is allocated. We have the grants that rapidly get out the door. And of those dollars, about 50% of that has actually been spent. These are reimbursement grants to the local government. So when they spend $100 and send us a bill, we'll send them $50 or whatever the ratio is. So about half of that money from the $23 million has actually been spent at the local level. The as you look at this list, most of these projects are levee projects. Ada, Climax, Melrose, Oakport Township, which is the township on the north side of Moorhead, which has subsequently been annexed by Moorhead, is now actually part of Moorhead. City of Oslo, levee. And then Otter Tail County, which is a lake outlet project that I'll touch on a bit more. And then Arroso River Watershed District project, which was enhancing an impoundment project there. And as you'll see on the right-hand side of this, we expect completion of most of these projects in 2017. The Oslo project was completed last fall. The Otter Tail County project, which is the a lake outlet project, it's Little MacDonald, Krebs, and Paul Lake. These lakes are landlocked. There's no surface outlet. There is a surface outlet if water gets high enough. The water would have to rise about another 8 feet, I believe it was, before it would flow naturally out. And these lakes have been above the ordinary high water level, which is the level that historically you would think would be a normal level for the lake. So they've been about 2 to 4 feet above that ordinary high water level and caused significant damage to homes, septic systems, erosion damage. So this project has moved a little bit slower than the others, and that's been due to some historical investigations that needed to be addressed, and also some other right-of-way concerns. But that design and construction, they are ready to commence construction now in 2017, and we would expect the project to be done in probably not in the late 17, but it would go into 2018. And Capital Rourke has represented the Little MacDonald Lake and Otter Tail County folks, and he can provide any more detail, or I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Ms. Gordon. I'll just ask, this completion summer 2017, several of them here, is that when it was scheduled? That's when you expected it to be done?
Mr. Chairman, I would say yes.
Would Mr. O'Rourke say yes too?
Mr. Chairman, for the record, my name is Capital Rourke, and I am here representing the Little MacDonald Lake Association. I think with respect to the Otter Tail project, it has been delayed since 2015. There was in the initial route of that they had chosen there was a large Native American site that they then had to find a workaround. So the initial path that they were going to take had to be, they could not simply go around that archaeological site. They had to pick a different route. So if you look on this handout, there are some dollars spent on our initial route, and we've had to change the initial course of this pipeline, but we are now on track to be done by the end of 2017 and are still piping into the original, the Otter Tail River, which is the original plan.
Hey, Mr. O'Rourke, I was wondering, would your pre-design have picked up that there was an archaeological site there?
Mr. Chairman, I would expect it would have.
But it didn't?
Well, Mr. Chairman, this project didn't go through pre-design. This was a line item appropriation in the 2015 bill, and so money was provided to Otter Tail County as the local government sponsor, and that's when they started in earnest looking at the pipeline alignments. This has to be a pumped outlet to get the water to the Otter Tail River. So they wouldn't have had much look at routes prior to the appropriation.
Okay. Representative Gunther, did you have a question?
I do, Mr. Chairman. Just out of curiosity, what happens to the balance when the projects are done?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Gunther, when projects come in under the estimated cost, the balance goes into the, well, as you see on this line, the unobligated amounts, and we would provide those dollars to another project. This appropriation in 2015 provided the $23 million. It only identified the $10 million for Otter Tail County, and the rest of the projects were subject to the department's priority setting. And as I said, we set priorities based on the risk and the readiness of a local government and the ability to spend the money rapidly.
President Gunther.
Just out of curiosity, do we in the legislature know what you do with the money, or you just do it?
Mr. Chairman, we certainly present priorities to the department, and typical bills have had a list of potential projects. But often, when proponents come forward with a project, they are more optimistic on their timing than reality. As I think is, I guess, a little bit evident here with the Otter Tail Lakes project. So we've funded projects in phases. So we fund a project for a complete phase that's a standalone benefit, and look at multiple phases instead of giving the full funding for a project to a local community.
I still don't know what they do with it, but that's fine.
You sidestepped that one pretty good.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Gunther, I'd be happy to come around, and I plan on coming around and meeting with committee members and fully explaining that and the rest of our programs at DNR.
Thank you. Any other questions? Thank you, gentlemen.
You're welcome. Thank you.
And I'm informed that that's it. Therefore, unless somebody has any other further business to come before us, this case is closed.